Let's try to pick up our train of thought again. And before we get into where we left off, question was raised last time about verse 8 of chapter 2, the last part of verse 8. Some of the different translations, the way it's worded, and wanted to know why I had said what I said in class about the way the American Standard, that is the New American Standard, reads, about Solomon trying to find the answer to life in terms of his possessions. Verse 8 reads in this version, I collected for myself silver and gold and the treasure of kings and provinces. I provided for myself male and female singers and the pleasures of men. And there's a hyphen. And it says many concubines. And it was brought to our attention that the New King James does not read exactly that way. It seems more along the line. It mentions musical instruments in keeping with the mentioning of the male and female singers. All the reference material that I had, I could never find a definitive answer as to which translation is preferable. So I can't give any more of a concrete answer than what I said last week. I don't know why the translations differ on the ending of that verse. Both would fit the overall context, obviously. Solomon trying to make things that just not eternal, make them be the end-all and the purpose of living. So other than that, that's my answer. I couldn't find anything other than that. So I said that we would begin class with trying to clear that up, and that's all that I could find. Hope that suffices. Okay, so here's the outline that's on page 4 of your material. And this is the outline in the first part of the monologue, which is, of course, the vast majority of the book, chapter 1, verse 12 through 12 and verse 8. And we're talking about this search that Solomon's undertaking right now, trying to find how life is meaningful, what's the purpose of living, why am I here, what am I doing, where am I going, those types of questions. And in this particular section, we're talking about the vanity of his possessions and all the things that he built. Notice, as we mentioned in as we looked at verses 4, 5, and 6, all the things that he built, I made this for myself, I made that for myself. The one project not listed, of course, was the temple. That was not built for himself. He built that for God at the direction or at the instructions of God. So that was a different type of activity. And we also made mention of looking at Daniel chapter 4, Nebuchadnezzar's own words, when Daniel gave him that other prophecy, besides the one in chapter 2 and chapter 4. Sometimes men build these monuments to themselves as a testament to their great success. And that was certainly in Nebuchadnezzar's heart, as we remember. Look at the great Babylon which I have constructed. Am I not just the greatest thing that there ever was? And he had to be rebuked on that occasion. And so it can lead to warped thinking, and that's Solomon's case here, it seems. And so those things are not to be the purpose of life because they're not lasting. They're not eternal. And Solomon goes on to mention other things here. His wealth certainly helped him live that kind of a lifestyle. Pleasure, possessions, all those sort of trappings and so forth. We also made mention in the last bullet point there, which is question number, I was on page 7, that would be question number 10, last part of question 10. How Moses himself had warned about the kings. They will collect for themselves gold and silver, they'll collect for themselves chariots and horses. And Solomon certainly violated that very thing that Moses warned about in that particular section of the law. Solomon says, I did not refuse myself any pleasure. Verse 10 of chapter 2 here. I just experimented with it all. But he came to the conclusion, bottom of page 7, which took us to verse 11 of chapter 2. He says, thus I considered all my activities which my hands had done and the labor which I had exerted. And behold, all was what? Vain. Vanity. Nothing lasting is found there. That's not where life's meaning is. And he says it's striving after the wind, and there's no profit, he says, under the sun. And if you read that last phrase of verse 11, go back again to chapter 1 and verse 3. He says the initial question, what profit is there? What advantage is there for man in all his work that's done under the sun? So he's asking the same question. He's still trying to come up with the answer to this. Experiment. So, we get to the top of page 8 now. This is verses 12 through 23, sort of closing out this section. We We believe the last three verses of chapter 2 sort of serve as the conclusion to this initial search. So verses 12 to 23, just kind of leading up to that. What did he learn? What did Solomon learn through this experimentation? Verse 12. So I turned to consider wisdom, madness, and folly. For what will the man do who will come after the king except what has already been done? Look at this question he's asking. The man who repeats these same experiments, if any man will ever be so inclined to try to find the same answers that Solomon's trying to find, he asks the question. Now, the one who comes after the king, what will he learn that I didn't learn? What's the answer? Nothing. And in fact, if anybody tries this after Solomon, how will they compare to the king in terms of wisdom? They won't have his wisdom. That's right. So if he didn't find it out using this wisdom, then obviously what are their chances? Well, even less than his. They'll fail. So that's the question he asks. Now, he does admit, what about wisdom in verse 13 and the first part of verse 14? Well, it's better than foolish. Yes, I mean, that's obvious. That's obviously so. He's not saying that wisdom is unimportant. He does admit, I saw that wisdom excels folly on what comparative sense? As far as, well, light's better than darkness. It is. Verse 14, the wise man's eyes are in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. Now, that's generally true, of course. So again, he's just admitting a truism. But, he says, yet, despite that fact being true, what's the truth under the sun if one takes that viewpoint that if this is all that there is in life, then how does it end with respect to the wise man and the foolish man? They all come to the same fate. They come to the same end. So even though the wise man will do better than the foolish, the same fate awaits them both. Now, of course, that's not eternally true, is it? We're dealing here with wisdom under the sun. If this is all there is, and if we're going to try to find the meaning of life through possessions and pleasure and wisdom and so forth, then is the wise man any better than the foolish man? And the answer is no. The same fate befalls them both. This gets us into verse 15 now, through verse 16. He says, then I said to myself, as is the fate of the fool, it will also befall me. Then look at the next phrase, and again, I'm assuming I haven't checked all the translations, so maybe I need to stop doing this. but I can't help myself. What does the next part of verse 15 read in your version? After he says, as is the fate of the fool, then it will also befall me. Is it a question? What does he ask? Who has the New King James? Somebody read that for me. Sister Mary Ruth? Well, just read all of verse 15 for us. Just... Okay. Why then was I born wise? Why was I more wise? All right. Mine says, why then have I been made extremely wise? Solomon's even saying, what about his own wisdom in this discussion? Yeah, how has this really helped me? I mean, no one's ever going to be any wiser than I am. God gave me this great gift of wisdom. But I'm failing in terms of finding life's meaning just with my wisdom. So I don't think he's so much despairing. He's just admitting, how has this really helped me in my search if I'm really going to find life's meaning with this? I think that seems to be his thinking. He says this too, last part of verse 15, this too is vanity. For there is no lasting remembrance of the wise man as with the fool, inasmuch as in the coming days all will be forgotten, and how the wise man and the fool alike die. That sounds kind of cynical, doesn't it, if we want to put that kind of a spin on it. But we've already noted that Solomon is no cynic. Let's not pervert the text. He's just saying, if this is all that there was, then it would be true. The wise and the fool, they die alike. There's no lasting advantage. All were forgotten, and it all stops right here. So then why have I been made so wise if it will profit me no greater than the fool if this is the meaning of life? Yes, Brother Lambert? Yes, it's under the sun. That's correct. With wisdom without God. Living a life without God in your life, without a relationship with Him. That's the point that he's making. So there's no lasting remembrance of either, and we've already covered that also back in chapter 1 and verse 11. He had already said there is no remembrance of earlier things. Generations come and go. We can only hearken back so far, and then we all forget what was done five generations ago in your family. I couldn't tell you. That's just beyond my ability to remember and keep that current in my mind. So this is why the answer to his search was not to be found in wisdom. As he's telling us here, this is verses 12 through 18. And he also says that he hated Lot, for the work which had been done under the sun, this is verse 17, was grievous to me. Everything is futile. Remember he said back in those passages, the crooked can't be straightened. We made mention there, that does not mean if something is made crooked because of sin, well, that can be straightened, can't it? Through repentance. He's talking about all these puzzles of life out here that are beyond our ability to reason and think. We can't straighten them. We don't possess that kind of wisdom. Only God is able to figure those things out. That's beyond us. And there's much grief in wisdom, he's already said. So again, last part of verse 15, he seems even to admit his own limitations regarding this certainty. The last phrase there of verse 15, this is vain. My wisdom is even vain in trying to use it for these purposes. So, verse 17, he says, thus I hated life. Now again, that sounds cynical. He sounds like a depressed man on the verge of suicide. And we know that's not the case. He says, the work which had been done under the sun and the fruit of his labor. And he's not going to tell us why it's vain and futile to make that the purpose or the reason for living. Look now, starting in verse 18. He says, thus I hated all the fruit of my labor for which I had labored under the sun. Why, Solomon, the last part of verse 18? I'm going to have to leave it for who? Somebody will come after me, and there's a reason he gives in verse 19 why this is so grievous. I work myself to the bone all my life because I think this is what defines greatness. This is what identifies me and defines me. This is the reason for my existence. All right, so let's say I just work myself to the bone and I accumulate this huge pile of things, possessions, pleasures, all these things. Boy, that's just awesome. But he's already mentioned, I'm going to have to die. And then that pile is not going to travel with me. Remember, you've read historically, when the Egyptians would bury their pharaohs, what did they put in the pyramids and the tombs? All this stuff, right? To go with them on their journey. Well, where's that stuff stayed? In the tomb. It stayed right there. It doesn't go with us. And so his bemoaning here, if we can call it that, verse 18, or verse 19 rather, it's going to stay here. And the question that perplexed Solomon, well, it didn't really perplex him, but he's agonizing over it, is what? Yeah. Is he going to be stupid about it, or is he going to be smart about it? Yes. And I'm gone, so I won't be able to affect his decision. It'll be all under his control totally. Will he be wise with it, like I was wise? Or will he do just the opposite of what I would have done? I would be powerless to affect him either way. So he says, that's why I hated all the fruit of my labor. Who knows whether he will be a wise man or a fool, yet he will have control over all the fruit of my labor for which I have labored by acting wisely under the sun. This too is vanity. Yes, Brother Lambert. In what verse? Verse 17. You can't grab it. That's right. You'll be as successful in making possessions the meaning of your life as if you could catch the wind in your hand, and you're not going to succeed there. That's a powerful phrase in the book, Brother Lambert. I agree with you. So He says it wouldn't last, it's vain. And striving or grasping after the wind, it'll be left to another after him. Last part of verse 18. And now in verse 19, here is the reason why he sort of bewails this. Whoever's going to manage it after him. And did he have Rehoboam in mind when he wrote this? Well, I can't prove it, but that certainly would fit. And early on, as you know the biblical record, when they come to Rehoboam following Solomon's death, remember the request they made of him? We can just briefly summarize it. Yeah, your father was really hard on us. And so, in fact, who was the one leading that delegation? You remember? Jeroboam. Make our burden light and what? You will have us. We will serve you. We'll follow you. We'll be your servants. And so Rehoboam had to take counsel, didn't he? And he, of course, sought the wisdom of two groups. First group was who? It's sort of out of the book, but I think it fits. The ones who had served Solomon. And what did they say about this request? It's a good idea. You ought to listen to them, and you'll have their loyalty and their allegiance. But then Rehoboam, of course, he's the new king, he's the new sheriff in town, you know, and so he's going to do things his own way. And so then he seeks the second group of wise men. And how much wisdom do these men have? Huh? Yeah, they were his age. What did they know? But they said basically, oh no, Rehoboam, don't listen to that. They said, you need to tell them. In fact, what was the comparative phrase they used? My little finger is as thick as my father's waist. And that means what? Just basically put. If you thought that was bad under him, you haven't seen anything yet. I mean, I'm really going to put the wood to you. And so, here's a situation where Solomon was wondering, the man after me, what's he going to do? Well, Rehoboam did have to make a choice after Solomon, and he made a terrible choice. Of course, it was all according to God's providential plan to split the kingdom, as he already announced to Jeroboam, but he used that incident to bring about the division in the kingdom. So, here's why, and let's look at now some familiar passages. This is question 15, and you know these rather well. But let's just go ahead and talk about them. Turn to Luke chapter 12, and let's plug this. Let's plug this in here. Luke 12 and 1 Timothy 6. We're going to flip back and forth between these two just for a couple of minutes. Luke 12 and 1 Timothy 6. And again, we'll be reminded, not shockingly so, but we'll be reminded how harmonious the Scripture is. So he says this fails. These owning these possessions, these pleasures, having the lifestyle that can accumulate all these things, this is vain and is striving after the wind. And let's first reason why from Luke 12, verse 15. This doesn't define the man. Listen to Jesus himself, Luke 12 and verse 15. Of course, we know this is right before the parable of the rich farmer or the foolish farmer. And Jesus is discussing great things about the kingdom. That's the previous discourse, at least through verse 12 of Luke 12. And he gets interrupted, doesn't he, by somebody in the crowd. And they've got a carnal request. We want the inheritance divided. My brother's not being fair. And so basically his request is, make him. Jesus, make him do what he ought to do. And the response in verse 15, he says, beware, or be on your guard against all form of greed or covetousness. And the reason why, the last part of verse 15, why will this kind of lifestyle fail? Okay. Your life is not measured. It doesn't consist of what you own. And as has been said before, the reason why is because those things aren't as eternal as you are. And they'll fail. They'll stay right here. He's already said back in Ecclesiastes, this stuff will be left to another person to manage and to own and to use. And so that's why it's vain, because they don't really define you. And so we've got to get it set in our heads, don't we? And It's a shame sometimes to have to teach and preach this to Christians. We know the world lives this way, but sometimes we get so wrapped up in materialistic thinking and things. And even brethren have to be reminded, don't live that way. Those things don't define you. You're so much greater and so much better than all the things you could ever own. These things aren't going to leave the world. They're going to stay right here. Continuing on in the parable, we'll not read it, but basically, 16 through 20 is the parable of the farmer. Jesus then makes his application in verse 21. But how does the parable teach that these things won't leave the world? What was the farmer's basic thinking about his bumper crop that came in? That's right. My present facility is just not adequate. Oh, I got a great idea. I'm going to tear that down and build a much bigger one. Then I'm going to store it. Then I'm going to kick back and say, self, you just sort of that Nebuchadnezzar kind of thinking, you've really done well. So take your ease, retire, and eat, drink, and be merry. I've got many, many years ahead of me. And what did God say? You don't have even what? One more night. And then he asked the question that's on point here. What was the question? Well, no, it's verse 20. And now, who will own, or whose will these things be that thou hast provided? Who's going to get them after you're gone? See, that's exactly what Solomon is saying. And then in 1 Timothy 6 and verses 6 through 8, we see Paul saying, the answer is in verse 6. When you have this kind of discussion about making this the meaning of life, Paul tells us, what's the real answer? Being what? Being content. We have to learn contentment. That's a hard thing to learn sometimes, to grasp and master, isn't it? We struggle with that. Verse 7, he says, we brought nothing into the world, and that's true. We just come in totally empty-handed. And how do we leave? The exact same way. We leave empty. And if we have food and clothing, or food and covering, food and raiment, the King James says, with these we shall be content. So that's why it fails, because these things that we're trying to make so important won't leave the world. He goes on to say in 1 Timothy 6 that loving them is a snare. And he never says money is the root of all evil. As has been said, he says, the love of money, the wanting of money is the snare and the root. And then Jesus concludes back in Luke 12, you can have all these things, but you're still poor because you're not rich where it counts. You're not rich toward God. So this is some great teaching. And it's just as relevant today as when Solomon wrote this. His people needed to hear it, but you know what? We do too. We need this lesson. Yes, Brother Langley. Correct. That's right. Yes, and we'll come to his point about the proper understanding of blessings and materialism, of materialistic things just in a moment, but you're right. He never said owning them, having them, is wrong. Because he admits in coming verses, how do we get them? They're a gift from God. If it was wrong to have them, then God wouldn't give them to you. If this, the having them is wrong and detrimental to our spiritual health. So, a man who attempts to find life's meaning and happiness through possessions will not even be able to enjoy peaceful rest at night. Look at back in our text now, verse 23. He says, because all his days, this is Ecclesiastes 2, verse 23, because all his days his task is painful and grievous. Now he works hard. Even at night, his mind does not rest. Why? Why cannot the man who lives this way even have one peaceful night? He's concerned about getting more, keeping it. How can I protect it? Who's going to steal it from me? What am I going to have to do to guard myself? And his mind is just constantly going about protecting what I think my identity is. And he just he just becomes a nervous wreck. Can't even enjoy life. And that's a tragedy. So again, looking at these verses, and I sort of jumped in at verse 23. We skipped a few verses. Let's read them all together. After he says in, this is verse 19, Ecclesiastes 2. Who knows whether he, that is the one coming after the king, who knows whether he will be a wise man or a fool, yet he will have control over all the fruit of my labor for which I have labored by acting wisely under the sun. This too is vanity. Therefore I completely despaired of all the fruit of my labor for which I had labored under the sun. When there is a man who has labored with wisdom, knowledge, and skill, then he gives his legacy to one who has not labored with them. This, too, is vanity and a great evil. For what does a man get in all his labor and in his striving with which he labors under the sun? Solomon is saying, basically, here I can live as wisely as I can in accumulating these things. Did Solomon get his gain through ill-gotten means? No indication that he did. The Scripture doesn't tell us that. Now, of course, we know he went off in his later years and was not living as he ought to, but the gaining of the material blessings, becoming rich, that's certainly, in fact, he had nothing to do with that, did he? God gave it to him. It was a gift. And that's why he's going to say here at the end of verse 24, that's exactly his situation. We all know people in the kingdom who are wealthy. I know some Christians who, as far as I can judge things, and I'm not the final judge of court, but as far as I can determine things, they're just as fine and faithful people as you'd ever want to meet, and they're very materially blessed. So there's no insinuation that having them is wrong. But obviously the point he's making here is how we see them, how we view them, what we do with them, how we try to make them the most important thing that there is. So he says, not even this man can sleep at night, worry's going to consume him. He says, this is another grievous vanity. Yes, I agree. It is. In fact, I heard one preacher say one time, and I've always remembered this. I could tell you his name was, but that's not really important. He said, think about this. What really is more hurtful to man, prosperity or adversity? How would you answer that? Which one's worse? Prosperity's harder on you. Why? It can lead, and most often does lead, him away from God. And the man who's in adversity, the man who knows he's needy, what's he more apt to do? He'll recognize his own deficiency and knows, I need help. And he'll more than likely turn, hopefully he'll turn, to the correct source. So, but our lifestyle says, oh no, it's worse to be poor. It's worse to be... No, it's not. It's worse to be prosperous because of the warnings the Scripture gives about this. And I agree with you, Brother Lambert. He's telling us here about this kind of lifestyle. You look thoughtful again. You want to say something else? Yeah. That. What did he say? The Lord giveth, and the Lord taketh away. So his attitude was right about that. You are correct. So here he is bemoaning this particular kind of a situation through verse 23 is what he finishes up this discussion, if you will, about what he'd learned. So anything through chapter 2 and verse 23? Have we answered pretty much the down through question 16? Anybody? Comment or question? I'm sorry, say that again. Yes.
Yes.
If we do just wrap ourselves around this kind of thinking and living and mindset, it's a cancer. You know, just it'll just eat at you all the time, and finally we'll consume. Yes. That could be equature as well. You are correct. But in context, we're sticking with the prosperous thinking, because that's what Solomon is talking about here. Okay, so as we come to the end of this first major section of the monologue, that is the main part of the book, Solomon is now going to give us his conclusion. And look how question 17 is phrased, the first part of it. And I think this is proper to see it this way. This, to me, is Kohelet's first glimpse, or his first reach above the sun. Now, you don't see in the book the phrase above the sun. That's always under the sun. But this, it's statements like this that tell us this writer, this man, is not a cynic. He's not a fatalist, all right? He is a man who's giving us the truth about his own life's experiences. And here he gives us the first reach above the sun. Verses 24 through 26. Angela, read those three verses for us, please. Yes, the end of the chapter. All right. True words. This is true, proper perspective of what he's been talking about so far. Man shouldn't make possessions and pleasure. He's been talking about that since the middle part of chapter 2. He said, don't make that the focus of your life. Rather, what's he say? Verse 24. There is nothing better for a man than to eat and to drink, that is, enjoy the fruits of his labor, and tell himself that his labor is good. Of course, as long as it's honorable. If you're doing something that's sinful, you can't justify it in that way, but it's got to be honorable labor. This also I have seen, that it is from the hand of God. It's a gift. So let's stop right here and just ask the very obvious question. What is the purpose then for the things that Solomon has been talking about in chapter 2? These possessions, these pleasures. So what if you're able to build parks and ponds and forests and houses and whatever? Let's say you can do all that. Nothing wrong with that, as long as what? You recognize where it came from. You share with others. You bless other people. You use it to serve others and to serve God. All those things come into play. See that as a gift of God, there's not one thing wrong with that kind of thinking. In fact, that would be the proper way to look at them, wouldn't it? That would be the proper perspective. Yes, Mary Lou. Yes, chapter 7. Yeah, you and I were talking about that. Was it last Tuesday or was it Sunday morning? I forget. It was a great illustration of what she's saying. You didn't hear what Mary Ruth said. You know, the accumulation of all these things, a person just involves him or herself in this for years. I'm collecting a set of whatever, and let's say you hunt the world over and you finally find the last missing piece that makes the set complete and now makes it valuable. Well, that's great. But one day, it's going to wind up on a wagon. Well, either one or two places. It'll be a cause of infighting in the family, those that are left. And if nobody wants it, or they can't come to the conclusion who gets it, and it goes on the wagon at the auction, right, and goes to the highest bidder. And gets scattered into the... Or it may get scattered to the four winds among 10 families. That's right. That's a perfect illustration of the very vain type of thinking he's been talking about. And that's why being so carnally minded is just, it's just so empty and it's just so shallow and it's such a waste of one's life. All right, let's look at some of these New Testament passages. And this is nothing new here. This just sort of reemphasizes what he's saying. Tammy, turn to those two in Acts 14 and Acts 17. We'll read those back to back.
Acts 14:17 and Acts 17:25. Lauren, Matthew 5:45 in the Sermon on the Mount, if you would please. And then Ralph, if you'll turn to James 1, those two verses in James chapter 1, verses 5 and 17. So here's what some New Testament preachers, the Son of God Himself being one of them, said about enjoying gifts from God in life. All right, Tammy, Acts 14:17 and 17:25. All right, now that was a statement of Paul preaching on the first journey. God gives us rain, fruitful seasons. It's all a gift of God. And then his sermon on Mars Hill, Acts 17:25. All right, it gives you all things, life, breath, and all. All right, Lord, Matthew 5:45, Sermon on the Mount. Right. Those are blessings that are indiscriminate, right? Whether you're evil or good, you get sun, you get rain, because all mankind need it. Right. Then Ralph, James 1, verses 5 and 17, please. Verse 5, is God a liberal giver? Gives liberally to people who don't even deserve it. That's us. Every good and perfect gift. So all these things, we see the teaching of Scripture over and over again. Whatever good, whatever blessings will come in your life and my life, we don't deserve any of it. We're not really the ones that bring it about. It's all at the hand of God. You ever heard that phrase? Someone said, well, I'm a self-made man. What do you think about that? He doesn't exist, does he, Bob? Not such a creature. Even if through your talents and your work ethic and your knowledge and skill, whatever it is that you use to amass great wealth, possessions, or achievement in life, well, even then you have to admit what? God allowed me to have this knack or this skill, or to go to school and hone this skill and to develop it all comes from God. I mean, not any of it is self-invented, self-made. It's just not so. So Solomon says, here's the conclusion. Okay, here's what I want us to see. There's nothing better for a man than to eat and drink and tell himself that his labor is good. This also I have seen, that it is from the hand of God. Now, verse 25 is an oft-debated verse in this context, and maybe debate's too strong a word. It's cause for good discussion. The King James, both old and new, and of course the wording isn't exactly the same, but this is basically the idea from that translation. Solomon says, for who can eat or who can have enjoyment more than I? And that's true. There's nothing wrong about that, because in context, what has he already established about himself? I have had it more than anybody else. And if a person wants to know if you can find happiness, who can have enjoyment eating, partaking of these pleasures, living that kind of lifestyle, more, who can do that more than me? Well, that's true. The other translations, most of the later ones, the American Standard, the New American Standard, and even in the Septuagint, it reads this way: for who can eat and who can have enjoyment without Him? And the Him, of course, being a reference to God. And of course, that is true. So whichever one you like to be holding to, I'll leave it up to you. But it seems to me the second one is the preferred translation because of the context he's talking about in these last three verses. The first option is true. But what he's been saying, at least starting here in verse 24, and then in verse 26, seems to complete this thought. If we take the second meaning here, that is to say, who can have enjoyment, who can have this kind of blessing in life without God? Well, the answer is, of course, who? Nobody. You can't have these things without the one who liberally gives them. And verse 26 leads us to that conclusion because he says, at the first part of the verse, for to a person who is good in his sight, that is to say, well, how would you interpret that? For a person who is good in his sight means what? A godly person? All right, he's trying to live in the way that the Lord wants him to. He doesn't take these things and try to make them the meaning of his life. He just keeps them in perspective. He uses them. He innocently enjoys them. Nothing wrong with that. He lives that kind of lifestyle. The one who lives that way, what does he say he gets? All right, he gets joy, right? God has given him wisdom and knowledge and joy regarding those things. He will bless him. But to the sinner, now, all of us were sinners. Well, we are. But what is the meaning of that phrase then? And it's a contrast to the first person. It's the person who doesn't live like he's supposed to. The person who maybe lived like Solomon did in this respect, who tried to make these things the meaning of his life. His perspective was out of kilter, so to speak. What about to that person? What does God give? Wisdom and peace and joy and knowledge? The thing we've just been talking about. He gives them anxiety, worry. He frets over these things. He will only gather and collect. He'll gather and collect, but for whose benefit? He says. For another. Is that what he says? For another. Who is good in God's sight. And this too is vanity and striving after the wind. So it seems to me that the understanding of verse 26, at least in my mind, helps me understand that verse 25, it seems the proper translation will be, for who can eat and who can have enjoyment, that is to say, regarding these things without God? Because behind it all is God. And your response to Him and to His will determine how these things will be at work in your life. So the determining factor in that is me, what I do with them, how I live with them. So all this sinner will ever know is vanity. And his life won't be purposeful. And again, that's the whole meaning of the book. I want to find the purpose to living. I want to find the reason for life. If I make it things like that, it won't work. All right. That's through chapter 2. We've pretty much covered the search. Solomon's initial experimentation, trying to find the meaning of existence. Any comments or questions through page 8, which is chapter 2? Yes, sir. We don't always know the reason why God brings events in our lives, do we? We just don't know. In fact, and you mentioned this idea of it being a test. God's not trying to trick us. God doesn't want us to fail, obviously. It's not that kind of a test, but He wants to see what we'll do with it. And sometimes even the Word of God will test us. Remember the offering of Isaac? Hebrews 11 says that by faith Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac. So sometimes even trying to follow the will of God, even without riches and blessings, these kind of things, it's a test. And we have to measure up. That's a good point. I just, as we study these particular verses, I mean, this is just as relevant today. We need to hear this as when he wrote this. Especially given our crazy mad chasing after the trying to find the goal to end the rainbow lifestyle, we need to hear this. All of us do. And Christians, that's why we're struggling so much in the kingdom with carnal materialism. The truths of this book address it just exactly head on, I think. And we need to heed. Yes. Right. Do you think God will give you material blessings to tempt you to sin? Well, we know that's not so because the Bible says God doesn't tempt man. He's not doing it to cause you to fail. I mean, how easy would it be for God to cause you to fail? That'd be easy because He's God and we're who we are. He gives us things that we know that He knows we can handle. He won't give us what we can't handle. 1 Corinthians. I thought the same thing. Mm-hmm. That's correct. Mm-hmm. Yes, right. And that was his condemnation. You are correct. He couldn't handle 5 or 2 talents. That wasn't his proclivity. Okay. Well, let's move on now to the second. We got about 7 or 8 minutes left, so let's at least start this. This gets us to page 9 now, and start of lesson 4. And this is the next main section, and there's a major typo on top of page 9, and you may have a corrected version of it or not. But the box up there where it says the problem, understanding God's providential rule over life, that should be 3 in verse 1 through 5 in verse 20, not 1 verse 12 through 2 verse 26. So I apologize for that. I hope that didn't cause you any confusion. That should be chapter 3 verse 1 through chapter 5 and verse 20. That's the next section here, I believe, of this main section, this main body of the book. All right. So, problem, we've had the search. Solomon's gone through his experimentation. I've tried to find life's meaning. I looked under every rock, behind every tree that there was. I mean, I tried to find it anywhere I could find it. And everywhere I looked, came up a dead end. The meaning of life is not found there. So that brought about, it seems to me, a problem. That is to say, okay, I'm admitting that God's in control. God is sovereign. He providentially rules life, living. He does. And Solomon admits that. But there's a problem in that I see some things in life that just puzzle me. I don't have an answer for them. Remember chapter 1, verse 15. Things in life that are crooked will not be straightened. And that means by human wisdom or wisdom under the sun. So here's the problem as Solomon sees it. And let's first take the first 11 verses of chapter 3. I believe there are some things. Here's the second box there, middle of the page almost. Solomon, he has some admissions that he makes regarding the world that's controlled by God's providential sovereignty. And as I've listened here in the material, I've got, there's three. I believe Solomon admits, and he doesn't do so regretfully. He just admits, I believe these are so. Even though I see this problem out here, I must admit these things are true. Number one, he admits that God appoints all things. This is the first 11 verses of chapter 3. How's the chapter begin? All right, there is an appointed time for everything. Is that how the New King James reads through? How does chapter 3, verse 1 read in the New King James? Okay. All right, to everything there is a season or an appointed time, and there is a time for every event under heaven, is how the American Standard reads at the end of verse 1. All right. Now, the next, the ensuing verses, 2 through 8, this is question 1. Here's 14, I'm going to call them couplets. They're just short, contrasting statements. There's a time for this and time for that. Time for this and time for that. You've seen these verses on coffee mugs. Framed portraits on a wall. Off-quoted text of Scripture. And it seems to me now that Psalm is going to emphasize God's sovereign control over events that happen in life. Some will teach that, well, there's a time that man must know to do this and a time that man must know to do that. I don't think that's what he's saying. Not at all. That's not the context. The overall context is God's sovereign control. If if these activities or these actions were things that man must find the right time to do them, then that gives man more credit than he deserves. And besides that, look at some of these. The very first one, verse 2. What's the first half of the first couplet, as I'm calling it? There's a time to give birth or a time to be born. Now, what among us or who among us choose to be born? We don't. We may choose in our own lives as a husband and a wife, okay, let's start having our children now. We may make that decision. But I don't believe that's what he's talking about. He's talking about these things, these actions in life where God controls them, even in things that man might choose. He says, there's a time to plant. He said that. That's what last part of verse 2. A time to plant and a time to uproot what is planted. Well, you may decide, well, I'm going to plant my beans. It's time to plant my corn. Well, that may be your choice. But even in that, aren't you still subject to conditions that only God controls? The rains and the seasons, the sun, all those things are factors that man does not control. So I believe that's really the discussion he's talking about here. Through verse 8. And I've asked here in question number 2, how might some of these couplets produce a puzzling world? If these are things under God's control, how might they be puzzling? Well, in this respect, I believe, providence brings about conditions where one day we may do the first half of the couplet, and the next day what might be the case? Just the opposite. And so we're left to scratch our heads saying, okay, what's up with all this? I don't get why it's this way and then why it's this way. So none of these things are under our control. So again, as our time is just about up, let's see, I've got to... I parked a little fast back there, and I'm going to go by my watch. But that's the official time in class, is my watch. We're just about a minute more, I promise. All right. So, at least I want you to think about that with respect to question 2. Through verse 8, all of these things, time to search, a time to give up what is lost, time to throw stones, a time to gather stones. You read all these verses, time to weep, time to laugh, time to love, time to hate, time for war, and a time for peace. God's in control of all these things. So with all these conditions that Solomon says, here's what happens in a life or in a world that God controls providentially as sovereign. In verse 9, what question does he still ask? What profit is there? What profit, or what is man's profit from all that which he toils, or that he does under the sun? Go back and look and compare that to chapter 1 and verse 3, when the first question was asked. What was the question there? Same basic question? Same thing. What advantage or what profit does man have in all his work which he does under the sun? If all of these things define living, these couplets, these contrasting activities here, then how does this give meaning to life? He says in verse 10, these tasks are given by God to the sons of men to occupy themselves. My version reads. And so that's the last part of question 3. That's how Solomon makes his final observation, at least for our class today. He viewed these tasks as something that God gives man to do to fill his time, and not meaninglessly, but this is what we do in life. Okay, we must stop there, for our time is up today. So Lord willing, we'll pick up top of page 10 next Tuesday morning with this admission, if you will, of what Solomon says God's rule sovereignly or providentially with life on that. Thank you for your attendance, and we'll see you next week.